Welcome to another Joy 94.9 podcast.
Hello and welcome to Reality Check. Today is Tuesday, the 2nd of February, 2010, and I'm your host, Tony Pittman. This is episode 26 of Reality Check here on Joy 94.9. Reality Check is a show designed to give you a healthy dose of reality. And we do that by promoting the art of critical thinking and skeptical analysis. Each week we bring you a roundup of LGBT news, followed by an in-depth analysis of an issue related to the paranormal or the pseudoscientific. And finally, we wrap up each show with a movie review. On today's show, after our LGBT news roundup, we're going to continue our long-running investigation of the alternative medicine known as homeopathy. We're now into week 3 of that analysis, and today we'll be looking at whether water has a memory, and whether, despite being completely implausible, homeopathy actually works in practice. Then in our movie review, we'll have a look at an independent American film gaining quite a bit of Oscar buzz at the moment, Precious. So for all that and more, stay tuned here on Reality Check on Joy 94.9. Okay, let's have a look at the LGBT news for the last week or so. And actually, all our news this week comes from the continent of North America. Let's go first to Mexico City, where in December, a bill was passed to allow same-sex marriage and adoption within Mexico City. And that law is due to come into effect in about 4 weeks' time on March the 4th. Now, the situation in Mexico is that the government of Mexico City, who passed the same-sex marriage law, is controlled by the leftist party, the PRD, or the PRD. But the president of Mexico, Felipe Calderón, is a member of the right-wing party, the PAN. And the Federal Attorney General's office last Wednesday, January 27th, who is obviously allied to the president, that office announced that federal prosecutors have applied to the Mexican Supreme Court for an order invalidating the new law on the grounds that it violates the Mexican Constitution. The next day, January 28th, Mexico City's mayor, Marcelo Ebrard, said that he would defend Mexico City's new law and that the federal attorney general was wrong and was making a grave mistake by trying to overturn the law. So that's not very good news coming from Mexico. However, commentators are saying that the Supreme Court will take some time to come to a decision, and it won't happen in time to stop the first same-sex couples from getting married in early March. So let's hope it all works out okay and the Supreme Court decides in our favor when it eventually does decide. And let's hope that we don't see a California-type situation where you have several hundred or several thousand same-sex couples who get married and then the right to marriage is taken away. I certainly hope it doesn't turn out like this in Mexico, but have no doubt, dear listener, that whatever does happen, Reality Check will keep you informed of every development as it occurs. By the way, a recent poll of Mexico City residents found that more of them approve of the new law than disapprove. Specifically, 46% approve, 43% oppose the law, and 11% are undecided. So that's encouraging to know. And of course, surprise, surprise, the Roman Catholic Archbishop of Mexico, Cardinal Norberto Rivera Carrera, came out a few weeks ago shrieking that the new law was immoral and reprehensible. But he is, of course, wrong. The new law is, in fact, just and commendable. And it's you, Norberto, by using your political power to try to impose your religious views on other people, it's you who is immoral and reprehensible. Do you understand that? No, I didn't think you would. Anyway, let's move north of Mexico for our next news item to Washington, D.C., where the news this past week has been all about the lifting, finally, hopefully, of the so-called Don't Ask, Don't Tell ban on LGBT people serving in the U.S. Armed Forces. President Obama gave his State of the Union address to a joint session of the U.S. Congress last Wednesday, and in it he said, and I quote, "This year I will work with Congress and our military to finally repeal the law that denies gay Americans the right to serve the country they love because of who they are." End quote. Now, this generated a lot of commentary all round, both for and against, but it looks as if 2010 will be the year in which repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell finally moves forward. Not that it will actually be repealed this year necessarily, but some progress towards that end will most likely be made. And that slow progress has in fact already begun. Yesterday, Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman Mike Mullen met with other members of the Joint Chiefs to discuss President Obama's repeal plan. The Joint Chiefs of Staff, by the way, is a committee made up of the heads of the four branches of the U.S. Armed Forces, the Navy, the Army, the Air Force, and the Marines. Then today, Tuesday, Washington time, so in a few hours from now for us, the Senate Armed Services Committee is due to hear testimony from Mike Mullen, as well as Defense Secretary Robert Gates, on how the Obama repeal plan might be implemented. This will actually be the first congressional hearing on Don't Ask, Don't Tell in 17 years, since that policy was introduced back in 1993. And it seems that Gates and Mullen will be advocating a gradual, incremental approach, probably setting up a committee to begin an investigation into the various options of ways to possibly repeal the ban. You know what these bureaucracies are like. Some LGBT activists are saying that we might see some form of progress immediately because they're expecting Defense Secretary Gates to announce that, first of all, as an interim step, the Defense Department will stop taking action to discharge service members whose sexual orientation is revealed by third parties or jilted partners. I guess we'll find out in a few hours from now. Ultimately, whatever happens within the Pentagon and the White House, the ban on LGBT service members is a legislative one, so requires an act of Congress to repeal it. Now, finally, briefly, our last news item for today also comes from the United States, in particular from the state of Hawaii, where there was some hope a couple of weeks ago that Hawaii would pass a very comprehensive civil unions bill for same-sex couples. The state Senate approved the bill 18 votes to 7 back on January 22nd. But when it came before the lower house last Friday, January 29th, they decided not to put it to a vote, effectively killing the bill. So there are a lot of very disappointed LGBT activists in Hawaii at the moment, especially as the lower house had already approved a similar bill last year. Apparently, 2010 is an election year in Hawaii, and so the members of the legislature are more concerned about keeping their seats by not doing anything controversial than they are about doing what is fair and just. I guess that's democracy for you. Okay, that concludes our LGBT news roundup for today. Let's listen to a song now, and when we come back, we'll continue our skeptical analysis of homeopathy. Can water somehow remember what was once dissolved in it? And if it can it then somehow cure you of an illness? Well, to find out, stay tuned here on Reality Check on Joy 94.9.
Made in Melbourne for the world. Joy 94.9.
Joy 94.9. Joy 94.9. Award-winning radio.
Welcome back to Reality Check. I'm Tony Pittman and the station is Joy 94.9. And the song you just heard there was Beauty on the Fire by Natalie Imbruglia, released in 2002. Okay, we now move into the part of the show where we undertake a skeptical analysis of a subject related to pseudoscience or the paranormal. And tonight we're going to continue our examination of the alternative medicine known as homeopathy. And today marks our third consecutive week of dealing with this troublesome issue. In week one, we had a look at the life of the inventor of homeopathy, the German Samuel Hahnemann, who published his seminal book on the subject exactly 200 years ago this year. We also looked at the first great principle on which homeopathy is based, the law of similars. Then last week, we had a look at homeopathy's second great tenet, the law of infinitesimals. Now, to put it as succinctly as possible, we discovered that both so-called laws are completely ridiculous and completely detached from reality. Now, if you're tuning in for the first time this week and would like to have a listen to those two previous episodes, well, you can download them from our website at realitycheckonline.net. So today we're going to get into an examination of the third and final great idea behind homeopathy, and that is the notion that water has a memory. Unfortunately, this idea doesn't have a grand sounding name like the law of similars or the law of infinitesimals, but it is a principle that has to be true for homeopathy to have any possibility of working. So just to briefly recap on what we talked about last week, most homeopathic remedies have been diluted so much that there is no possibility of even one molecule of the so-called active ingredient being present in the water. Homeopaths recognize this, and the way they get around it is by saying that it doesn't matter because the water retains a memory of the ingredient that was once dissolved in it. And at this point in the discussion, let me point out something that I haven't really mentioned until now, but to the homeopaths is of vital importance. And this is the practice of succussion. And to explain this properly, let's go back in time about 200 years to another supposed discovery made by Samuel Hahnemann. One day, Herr Hahnemann was carrying some of his homeopathic remedies on a horse-drawn carriage over the bumpy cobblestone streets of some German city when he had a revelation. He had apparently observed that his morning clients were healed by homeopathy, of course, but his afternoon clients got better even faster than the morning ones. He realized that all the shaking around on the bumpy wagon had supposedly increased the potency of his homeopathic remedies. And thereafter, Hahnemann included the ritual of vigorous shaking, or succussion, as an integral part of the dilution process. Together, the combination of dilution and succussion is known to homeopaths as the process of potentization. So that's where the idea of succussion, shaking the remedy after each dilution, came from. Not from some scientific analysis of the effects of that shaking, but just from a flash of supposed insight that Samuel Hahnemann had one day. But that's no surprise because, as we've already seen, homeopathy is not based on any scientific analysis of reality. It's entirely based on ideas thought up by Samuel Hahnemann about 200 years ago, regardless of whether they correspond with anything we now know to be true about the world around us. So, if you watch people making a homeopathic remedy in the lab, yes, it's always in some kind of lab. Notice how they love to surround themselves with the accoutrements of science. Anyway, if you watch them doing this, you'll see that they bang the flask rather brusquely on the bench several times after each dilution. This is the succussion process, and this, claim the homeopaths, is what transfers the vibrations of the molecules of the so-called active ingredient to the molecules of the water, the good old H2O. So it doesn't matter if there's no active ingredient left by the end of the dilution process. The water remembers what was diluted in it because the water molecules now vibrate in the same way as the active ingredient molecules once did. Right. Vibrations, huh? And how do we know this? Have we observed these vibrations and this water memory? Well, no. Nobody has. We just have to take the word of the homeopaths, because science, real science, can find no trace of any so-called transfer of vibrational energy. But homeopaths and other pseudoscientists love to throw around words like energy and vibrations without ever actually getting into too much detail. But this detail is actually pretty important in legitimizing their claim. What kind of energy are we talking about? And what kind of vibrations? And where are they exactly? Now, scientists have actually studied the physics of water very closely over many years and have a very good knowledge of how water molecules behave. Water at room temperature is a liquid. This means the H2O molecules are moving around constantly. And in fact, scientists have discovered that any short-range order that you could possibly create in those water molecules would only exist for about 1 picosecond. That is 1 trillionth of a second. So it would seem that the concept of water memory is in fact a purely pseudoscientific invention and has no relation to reality whatsoever. The truth is that no real scientist has ever discovered any way in which water could possibly have a memory of what was dissolved in it. And perhaps most telling of all, no homeopath, when blinded, has ever been able to tell the difference between a so-called homeopathic remedy and a glass of pure water, using any kind of scientific equipment they choose. I wonder why. And another thing that skeptics like to point out is this. If water molecules can somehow remember other substances they've come into contact with, then why would they only remember the so-called active ingredient? Why not, for example, the glass or metal or plastic of the container it's being diluted and shaken in? And given that at each step of the dilution process, you're adding water that comes from elsewhere, why doesn't that water remember what was once dissolved in it? Like dead animals, or bird poo, or human feces, for example, or other such savory ingredients? And how far back in time does it go? Do water molecules still remember when they were once part of Julius Caesar's urine? If you go back that far, then you could easily argue that any water you drink today is a dilution of everything in the world, and therefore should cure every possible illness. And then what about when you drop the water onto sugar pills and it evaporates? Don't the vibrations go away with the water molecules into the air? Or do they now stay in the sugar molecules? Well, as you can see, this whole concept of water memory is just as absurd as the other basic principles on which homeopathy is built. But okay, let's go along with the idea for a while. Let's pretend that water molecules somehow have a memory of what was once dissolved in them. Fine, but homeopathy still has to get over what is probably its biggest obstacle, and that is this. Even if water molecules do retain a memory of what they once touched, how could they possibly, when consumed, have an effect on the body? How could they have a noticeable clinical effect in treating an illness? They're just water molecules. And as we saw last week, for any known drug to actually have an effect on the body, the molecules of that drug have to bind with specific receptors on the membranes of certain cells. That's how all drugs, all active ingredients work. And everything inside the body is basically floating in a vast sea of water. We humans are about 60% water. So how could a few molecules of water with special memory affect anything in the body? Water molecules don't bind to receptors on cell membranes. Water is the liquid in which those receptors are floating, waiting for specific molecules to come and bind to them. So how could water molecules, with some odd vibration, have any effect on anything in the body? I don't know. The homeopaths don't like to get into those kinds of details. But because we're good sports here on Reality Check, let's continue to give them the benefit of the doubt. So let's do what we've tried to do with all forms of alternative medicine that we've examined here on Reality Check. First, we look at the theory. Is it plausible in the light of everything we know about science and how the world works? Then we look at the practice. Even if a treatment seems implausible, does it actually have a clinical effect when given to patients? So I think we've answered that first question quite definitively. Homeopathy is completely and utterly implausible from beginning to end. It is, in fact, probably one of the most implausible of all the so-called alternative medicines out there. So implausible, in fact, that James Randi's $1 million challenge, a prize available to anyone who can prove any paranormal or pseudoscientific claim, also covers the claims of homeopathy. Anyone who can prove that homeopathy has an effect on the body or that water has a memory will receive $1 million. And it probably comes as no surprise to learn that no one has yet won that $1 million, because a claim that goes against all the known laws of physics, chemistry, and pharmacology, well, that's a pretty hard thing to prove. But despite that, let's keep an open mind and look now at that second question. Does homeopathy actually work in practice? And by work, I mean have an effect beyond just the placebo effect. And to answer that question, you have to look at the published medical literature, the large-scale, randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled clinical trials. Trials that have been carefully designed to eliminate any bias on the part of the patient or the experimenter. Now, that's the way to find out whether homeopathy actually works or not. And guess what, dear listener? For a while there, these trials seemed to show that homeopathy was, in fact, effective. One of the most famous, or infamous, papers on homeopathy was published in the highly respected journal Nature in 1988 by French researcher Jacques Benveniste. And it found, to the surprise of many scientists, that homeopathic preparations did have an effect on white blood cells exposed to them. Now, how could this be? Did water have a memory after all? And was that memory somehow able to have an effect on the body's cells? Well, a team of skeptics, including the great magician and expert in human deception, James Randi, flew to France and, with the permission of the researchers, conducted a thorough examination of the methods the scientists were using to come up with their data. And guess what they discovered? They found that the researchers were not properly blinded. One woman in particular, whose task it was to look through a microscope and judge if the cells had been affected by the homeopathic remedy or not, actually knew which cells had been treated with homeopathic dilution and which ones with just pure water. So she was picking up the microscope slides and she would read on the label, oh, this one was treated with pure water. And then she'd look down the microscope and say, no, I don't think there's any effect here. And she'd note that down in her little book. Then she'd pick up the next slide and see the label saying that it had been treated with a homeopathic dilution. Then she'd look down the microscope and say, yes, I can definitely see signs that the cells here have been affected. So maybe it was conscious, maybe it was unconscious, but it was highly likely that her own biases were affecting the results that she took down. Because when James Randi and the other investigators changed the procedure of the experiment slightly so that the woman was now blinded and didn't know which cells had been treated and which ones hadn't, well, guess what? Quelle surprise! The effect suddenly went away, and the experiment showed that homeopathic solutions had no effect on human cells any different from pure water. It just goes to show the importance of blinding when doing scientific experiments. And by the way, dear listener, just as a side issue, I wanted to mention that the French researcher Jacques Benveniste, who conducted that flawed homeopathic research, was also the first person to come up with the concept that water retained a memory of substances once dissolved in it. That was not a notion that Samuel Hahnemann invented, because they didn't know about dilution limits 200 years ago. So he didn't realize that he'd diluted his remedies beyond the point where there could even be one molecule remaining. That was the idea of Jacques Benveniste, to try to save homeopathy from some of the criticisms that scientists were making about it. And just as another aside, Jacques Benveniste, in the late 1990s, also came up with the idea that homeopathic water memory could be digitized and sent to people via the internet. Yes, how can I put it? Monsieur Benveniste was not exactly someone who was entirely grounded in reality. Now, but that controversy about Benveniste's paper in Nature all occurred back in 1988. So what about since then? What have the clinical trials shown? Well, the results of clinical trials on homeopathy have developed in the way that a lot of clinical trials on a lot of other alternative medicines have also developed. The smaller, lower quality studies seem to show an effect from homeopathy. But in the large, high-quality, well-designed, carefully controlled studies, that effect disappears and homeopathy has no more effect on patients than a placebo. The most definitive study on the effectiveness, or not, of homeopathy was a meta-analysis conducted by Dr. Aijing Shang and several of his colleagues at the University of Bern in Switzerland. They pooled together the results of the 8 highest quality clinical trials of homeopathy conducted in recent years and published their conclusions in The Lancet in 2005. And their conclusion was, and I quote, "This finding is compatible with the notion that the clinical effects of homeopathy are placebo effects," end quote. The Lancet ran an editorial in the same edition entitled The End of Homeopathy and urged doctors to be honest with their patients about homeopathy's lack of benefit. So is this really the end of homeopathy? Well, obviously from the fact that you can still find homeopathic products in virtually every chemist in Australia, no, it's not. But I suspect that the tide might soon turn on homeopathy once more and more people find out what it really is. That it's not a gentle herbal remedy or something like that. It's pure water or pure sugar pills with supposedly magical vibrations that no one has ever been able to detect, not even the homeopaths. So I suspect it's just a question of getting the word out, and when people realize what homeopathy really is, it will hopefully start to slowly fade away. And speaking of getting the word out about homeopathy, I should mention one British group that's been doing that pretty successfully of late. They are the Merseyside Skeptics, who have organized a campaign called 1023, Homeopathy, There's Nothing in It. Now, they called it 1023 in reference to Avogadro's constant, 10 to the power 23, that we talked about last week. And just this past Saturday, January 30th, they organized a protest in the form of a mass international overdose. They held simultaneous events across the UK, as well as a couple in Australia and Canada, timed to take place at precisely 10:23 a.m. UK time, at which all the participants tried to overdose by swallowing a whole jar of homeopathic pills each. Of course, if homeopathy actually worked, they should all have dropped dead from such a massive dose, or at least felt some kind of effect. But apparently no one died. In fact, no one even felt the slightest effect. Which, of course, to the skeptics who took part, came as no surprise, because we know that homeopathic remedies have nothing in them. So taking a jar of homeopathic pills is about as threatening as swallowing a handful of hundreds and thousands. In fact, even less threatening, because at least hundreds and thousands have artificial colours in them, which could potentially do something. Anyway, the specific point of the 1023 mass overdose event was to protest the fact that Boots Pharmacies, the largest chain of pharmacies in the UK, not only sell homeopathy in their shops, but even sell their own Boots brand of homeopathic remedies. And as Boots is a very trusted brand in the UK, this is very misleading and harmful to consumers, because the customers think they're buying something which will actually help them, when of course it won't help them in the slightest, beyond the placebo effect. Now, if you want to check out the video of that mass overdose event, visit 1023.org.uk. That's the numbers, 1023. And then click on the 1023 event link. Now, finally, before we get into another song, if you have any questions or comments about what we've covered on the show, or maybe a topic you'd like us to cover on the show, please feel free to send us an email. The address is realitychecktony, that's T-O-N-Y, at gmail.com. You can also visit our webpage too if you like. That's realitycheckonline.net. Okay, let's listen to our final show for today, and when we come back, we'll get into this week's movie review.
Cruising for joy. It's safe listening. Joy 94.9.
Hey, this is Adam Lambert, and you're listening to Joy 94.9.
Welcome back to Reality Check with me, Tony Pittman, on Joy 94.9. Also streaming live at joy.org.au and also available as a podcast to listen to anywhere in the world on your little pod. The song you just heard there was Going Under by Canadian singer Billy Clippett from 2006. Okay, it's movie review time now on Reality Check, and the movie up for review this week is Precious, or to give it its full official title, that's Precious, based on the novel Push by Sapphire. So what was the novel Push by Sapphire? Well, it was the award-winning debut novel published in 1996 by the American writer Sapphire. And the film version has also been winning awards, including at Sundance, Toronto, and at the Golden Globes held a couple of weeks ago in Los Angeles. And it's also been generating quite a lot of Oscar buzz, particularly for the performances of its two main female characters. Now, the first comment to make about Precious is that this is not a film that will appeal to everyone. The content is very, very grim. The story revolves around the character of Clarice Precious Jones, an extremely overweight, illiterate, black 16-year-old girl who has just found out that she is pregnant, for the second time, to her own father. She lives with her mother, played by American comedian Monique, who constantly abuses her, physically, psychologically, and sexually. When the principal at Precious's school finds out that Precious is pregnant again, she kicks her out of school. But Precious enrolls in an alternative school with a group of other girls who have also been expelled from their schools, and she hopes to learn to read and write properly to pass her high school exams. So that's the setup for the movie. As you can tell, the writers certainly haven't held back in any way. If you want to depict what life is like for the lowest and most disadvantaged people on the socioeconomic scale, why do it by half measures? Why not go all the way? Oh, and I forgot to mention the interesting fact that Precious's first child, by her father, has Down syndrome, so they decided to name her Mongo, short for Mongoloid. Yes, I'm telling you, this movie really pulls no punches. And that's one thing I really appreciated about this film. It tries to realistically portray life for someone who has really been dealt a bad deck of cards in the casino of life. The type of person that you would normally never get to see depicted on film or even ever meet in your normal day-to-day life. I really like films that take you into these real but parallel worlds and try to show you what it's like for people who live there. In some ways, Precious even reminded me of Lars von Trier's Dancer in the Dark. In that film, Salma, played by Icelandic singer Björk, lives a life in which things go from bad to worse until they get as bleak as they possibly can be. Yet Selma escapes this harsh reality by drifting off into lavish musical fantasy sequences in which she's the star and everyone is singing and dancing and happy. The movie Precious also starts off using a similar device. Each time something really horrible starts happening to Precious, she drifts off into a fantasy world where she's a movie star with a very handsome boyfriend, attending gala movie events and being interviewed by the paparazzi. I liked these insights into Precious's internal world. They make the character more human and more accessible. And actually, I think that's what I liked most about the film. The insight into the life and mind of someone that you would just walk past in the street and regard as just some kind of freak or weirdo. In fact, I reckon that that's what really good filmmaking should do. It should allow you to vicariously experience someone else's existence and therefore come out of the film with an even better understanding of other people in society and thus more sensitive to their situation. For example, it's what last year's film, Samson and Delilah, did very well for Australian Aborigines. And this kind of goal is actually made pretty explicit in Precious, because there's even one scene where she's walking along the street and we hear her musing to herself about how everyone looks at her and thinks she's some kind of freak, but they don't know what she's really thinking or what her life is really like. And speaking of what her life is really like, the scenes of her home life, when Precious is at home with just her mother, are the best scenes in the film, and definitely the most tense. Precious's mother is a violent and unpredictable monster, and one of the most vicious and malevolent on-screen mothers since Piper Laurie played Carrie White's fanatically religious mother in Carrie. And it's her performance as Precious's mother that won Monique her Golden Globe a couple of weeks ago, and for which she's also the favourite to win the Oscar in a few weeks' time. She really makes your stomach tie in a knot every time she's on screen. And speaking of performances, I reckon the standout one in this movie is by first-time actress Gaburay Sidibe, who plays the title role of Precious. She does a really convincing job and is a great presence to watch on screen. However, having heaped so much praise on Precious, I have to say it's not a film without faults. It's kind of a messy film in a way, in that the tone changes from moment to moment. I would have preferred it to stay in its kind of gritty realism interspersed with fantasy escape sequences. But at some points, the film almost feels like one of those cliched Hollywood stories about the dedicated teacher with a heart of gold who takes on a class of no-hope students and teaches them to appreciate the good in themselves. The classic kind of to sir with love archetype. In fact, Paula Patton, who plays Precious's inspirational teacher, really acts like she's just walked off the set of Dangerous Minds. She even looks a bit like Michelle Pfeiffer. She just seems to be acting in a completely different movie from the rest of the cast. And there are other moments in Precious that just didn't gel well with the realism in the rest of the film. I reckon if you're going to do realism, do it consistently. Don't intersperse it with cliched Hollywood dialogue that just feels totally out of place. Now, one final comment on Precious is about one of the actors who surprisingly didn't seem out of place in this film, and that is Mariah Carey. I discovered that she can actually act. She does a pretty good job in this film, and without her makeup on, she blends in fine with the gritty reality. So overall, I would recommend going along to see Precious if you get the chance. It's a bit of a hodgepodge of styles sometimes, but I think it's a unique and memorable film, particularly for the grim and confronting subject matter it deals with. That brings us to the end of the 26th episode of Reality Check on Joy 94.9. I hope you enjoyed the show. Remember to send any questions, comments, or feedback to realitychecktony@gmail.com and visit our website at realitycheckonline.net. And remember to tune in at 10 o'clock next Tuesday for episode 27. Have a great week, everyone. See you next week.
This has been another Joy 94.9 podcast. Joy 94.9 is a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station committed to providing a voice for the diverse GLBTI communities. You can support our work by becoming a member or making a donation. For details, go to joy.org.au.